This is lecture 8 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiate Consciousness. Lecture 8 is entitled Possibilities of Aberration in Spiritual Research. When a man develops the states of consciousness of which we have spoken, he enters by means of each state of consciousness into a definite realm of the world. It is in this way that he learns to know those beings which belong for any age to that world. If, then, I wish to learn to know human beings as they live in the days following death, I must, by means of my consciousness, betake myself to the world in which the dead wander. I cannot observe them in their real forms in a different world. If I wish to observe the mercury beings, I must betake myself, by means of my consciousness, into the world of the mercury beings, must enter into relationship with that event, with those facts, which lie within the realm of Raphael, in the sense explained yesterday. In this sphere we learn to know primarily the healing forces of man's nature, etc. Thus one enters by reason of each state of consciousness into a certain realm of the world. In this way you may see that as human beings we can in a certain sense conceive the worlds as separated from one another and can conceive for each world its own special state of consciousness. Indeed, we must do this if we wish to know the world in the right way, for it is only thus that we can prepare ourselves in the proper manner to learn to know each being in its own true character. I will show you by means of a simple example whither such a knowledge leads us, a knowledge that undertakes to develop for definite realms of the world in the right manner the corresponding states of consciousness. Suppose that we see a plant, the leaves, the blossoms. We have seen that such a plant is really a mirrored image of what is outside in the world, form-creating and formed. What we can find in the world of which we have just spoken, this we find reflected upon the earth in our plants. How do we learn to know the plants? We learn to know them when we lift our consciousness into that world. But something very singular then comes to light. It becomes evident that we must make a vast distinction between plants that we find within the realm of the earthly. When we look at one or another plant, chicory or some other definite plant, it appears in this spiritual sense also to be different from other plants. Take, for example, the ordinary violet and compare this violet that you may have at once a very radical example with belladonna, with the deadly nightshade, and you will see, if you look at the plant world, as I have explained, how the violet stands quite open to the eyes of the soul when we are in that world to which the violet belongs, that is, the world of the empty waking consciousness. It is not so in the case of the deadly nightshade. The deadly nightshade, belladonna, draws its being from still other worlds into this. I may explain the matter in the following way. As you learn to know an ordinary plant, we see that it has its physical body, it has its etheric body, and then we see that the blossoms and the fruit are surrounded by the general astral element of the cosmos. You are looking, then, at the plant. Everywhere there sprouts out of the earth the physical part of the plant. Everywhere the plant has its ether body, and above this, as if it were enveloped in clouds, the astral. So it is in the case of such plants as the violet. In the case of such a plant as the deadly nightshade, it is different. In the case of the belladonna, it is like this. The plant grows, has here its blossom, here, within this, develops the fruit. But the astral element then enters into the fruit. The violet develops its fruit in the etheric element alone. The deadly nightshade absorbs the astral element with the fruit. It is in this way that it becomes poisonous. All plants which absorb the astral element out of the cosmos in any of their parts become poisonous. The same thing, then, which, when it enters into the animal, gives to the animal its astral body, forms the animal inwardly as a sentient being, when this thing enters into the plant, it makes the plant poisonous. This is very interesting, since we may say that our astral body bears within itself forces which, if they enter into plants, manifest themselves as poison. And it is in this way, indeed, that we must conceive poison. It is only in this way that we can come to an inner knowledge of poison, by knowing that in a normal manner we actually have within our astral body as human beings the forces of all poisons that exist, since this belongs to the being of man. In this explanation, I wish to give only a definite conception that we must hereafter employ in order to be able to enter into the distinction between the true and the false ways of spiritual investigation. What do we see in such an example? We have a violet. We have a deadly nightshade. If we have developed the right consciousness for each world, we see in the violet a being that remains in its own proper world, does not draw anything out of a world alien to itself. In the case of the deadly nightshade, we see that this draws into itself something from a world alien to it. The belladonna acquires for itself something that really should not belong to a plant, which only an animal should possess. And such is the case with all poisonous plants. They acquire that which they should not have as plants, but which belongs to the animal alone. In the entire universe there are many beings which belong to the most various realms of the world. In that very realm which we discover when we enter directly into the world, wherein we can follow the dead for a few years after their death, 10, 20, 30 years, until they leave that world, there are a great number of beings who really exist, but do not enter visibly into our physical world. I might characterize just such beings as a definite sort of elemental being. When, therefore, we follow a dead man after he has passed through the portal of death, we enter into a world in which there are all sorts of elemental beings, which possess forms that we might say really belong to that world. We may say, therefore, that since these beings belong to that world, they ought really to employ only the forces that are in that world. But there are among these elemental beings some who do not thus restrict themselves, but who watch when a man is writing, for example, and who observe all the activities carried out within the human world, that is, within that world through which human beings pass in the life between birth and death. There are such beings looking on continuously. The mere looking on is not in itself anything bad, for the entire plan upon which is... The mere looking on is not in itself anything bad, for the entire plan upon which is based what I am now telling you consists in the fact that all the worlds touching upon our own, the world, therefore, which we enter immediately after death, the world which we enter some decades after our death, that all these worlds are void of that which the human being has around him here upon the earth, and which he learns here on earth. When we enter into these worlds that touch upon our own, there is no such thing, for example, as writing, no reading in our sense of the word. Neither are there any flying machines in our sense, nor any autos in our sense, not even an ordinary team of horses in our sense. Nothing of all this really exists in these neighboring worlds. But we cannot say that the fact that we make automobiles here on the earth, that we write and read, that we write books on earth, which are, indeed, not read by the angels, we cannot say that all this is without significance for the world in general. But the fact is that in a certain sense such beings as those I have spoken of are under orders from the world which touches immediately upon our own. It is their duty to give attention, in a certain sense, to what human beings are engaged in doing. They are especially entrusted out of other worlds with the mission of occupying themselves with human nature and preserving what they learn in this way for future times. For you must remember that we men can carry our karma from one life into another, can carry from one life into another everything that affects our karma by reason of external culture. What we experience as human beings in an automobile, we can carry over from one earthly life into another, but not the construction of an auto. That which is derived merely from the forces of the earth, we human beings cannot ourselves carry over from one earthly life to another. For this reason, humanity, in the course of civilization, has founded something which it would lose if other beings did not come to its help. Now, these beings of whom I have spoken are especially detailed to preserve for the future that which the human being cannot himself carry over from one earthly life into another. This is the significant fact, that we have in our midst, in the world, bordering on our own, beings who are destined to carry over into the future what man cannot carry over to of his external civilization, in order that man may again have this in the future. You see, because of the fact that it was exceedingly difficult for many of these beings in past times to fulfill their mission, Therefore, much, very much, of what already existed in ancient times in civilization has nevertheless been lost to humanity. The important fact, then, which I would here place before you is this, that there are in our midst beings who are commissioned in the plan of the world to carry over into the future all that the human being himself cannot carry over from one earthly life into another. Such, above all, for example, is the abstract content of our libraries. This cannot be carried over by us human beings from one earthly life into another. For this purpose, special beings are required. And those spiritual beings with whom we human beings stand in direct relationship cannot do this. For this reason, we as human beings cannot do this either. These beings had to employ other beings who were for a long time alien to them, who had gone through an entirely different evolution from that of our spiritual beings connected with ourselves. In my books, I have called these beings who have gone through an entirely different evolution aromonic beings. This is an entirely different evolution, which comes into contact with our own in such circumstances as, for example, when we construct here an automobile. These, then, are beings who are able to understand a special instrument, a special institution for the present time, such, for example, as the construction of automobiles, by reason of their aromonic world forces, and to carry over into future times that which is once acquired by human civilization, whereas man himself cannot carry this across from one incarnation to another. By means of the conceptions which we have in this way acquired, we can now explain what a mediumistic person really is. We must naturally distinguish between a mediumistic person in the very broadest sense and what is called a medium in the proper sense of the word. For really we are all mediums if we use the term in the very broadest sense. We are, for example, soul and spirit human beings before we descend into the earthly world and live the life between birth and death. What we are in the spiritual world is incarnated in what we are here in the physical world. In the physical world, each of us is a medium for his own spirit. If, then, the word medium were employed in the very broadest sense, we could designate every being in some manner as a medium. But this is not what is meant when one speaks in the ordinary sense of a mediumistic person. A medium in our world, through which we pass in this life between birth and death, is a human being who has developed certain parts of his brain in such a way that these can be shut off from his being as a whole. At certain times, then, in the case of a medium, just those parts of the brain are not present as the basis for the activity of the ego, which essentially support this ego activity. When we truly say to ourselves, I, capital I, when we bring our own ego rightly into consciousness, this evolution of consciousness, this evolution of the ego, is always supported by very special parts of the brain. But these parts of the brain are shut off by one who is a medium. In this way, certain beings of the kind I have just described develop an appetite for creeping into these parts of the brain in place of the human ego. Such a medium, then, becomes the bearer of those beings who ought really to carry civilization over into the future. But whenever they seize upon a brain, these beings, which for a certain time is not occupied by its own ego, they then conceive a tremendous appetite to dive down into this brain. And when a medium is in a trance, as it is expressed, when the brain is thus shut off, such a being then creeps in, a being under the aromonic influence, which ought to carry civilization over into future times, creeps into the brain. And such a person is then during that time the bearer, not of a human ego, but of an elemental being, which is neglecting its duty in the cosmos. Just take this expression quite literally, which is neglecting its duty in the cosmos. The duty of such a being in the cosmos is to see how men write. They write by means of those forces which are anchored in those parts of the brain of which I have just spoken. But instead of merely looking on, as they otherwise always do, these beings notice wherever there is a mediumistic brain which can be shut out. They then creep into this and carry over into the present human world what they have learned of the art of writing through observation. Such beings, therefore, project into the present, by the help of mediumistic human beings, something which, according to their mission, they ought really to carry over into the future. The characteristic of the medium is that what ought to be developed in the future as capacities is developed in the present in a chaotic fashion, without meaning. Hence the prophetic element in the mediumistic being, hence the fascinating element. It is, indeed, something that works more perfectly than the human being of the present time, but it is introduced through beings in the manner I have described to you. Just as belladonna is mediumistic for the astral world, belladonna is a medium for certain astral forces which it draws into its fruit. So is a human medium, by reason of his special brain, a medium for these elemental beings, who must simply have a share in our civilization, because the human being cannot carry over everything from one earthly life into another. This is the real mystery of the mediumistic nature, the state of being possessed by definite beings. Now you may realize that these beings are, on the one side, actual creatures of the Ahrimanic beings. The Ahrimanic beings are present in the universe as beings of an intelligence far above that of humanity. As soon as we meet the Ahrimanic beings in the world, which touches immediately upon our own, or even, if we develop the power of perception, in the physical world, we are astonished at their tremendous intelligence, their surpassing intelligence. They are far more intelligent than any human being can be. In intelligence, they are real demigods. We gain a respect for such beings when we perceive how limitless their intelligence is. Something of this intelligence passes over to these creatures of theirs, these elemental beings that creep into the brains of mediums, dive down into them. Thus all sorts of significant things may, in this way, come from mediums. It is possible to learn all sorts of significant things, especially if one can look in full consciousness and with a highly evolved consciousness upon that which such mediums produce. It is not the case that if a man understands, in the right sense, the constitution, the actual condition of the spiritual world, he denies that all sorts of true things may come through mediums out of the spiritual world into the physical world. Important and significant things can be learned through mediums, but this is not a right way. Why not? You can learn this in the case of such plants as are plant mediums, mediums for certain astral forces which make them poisonous plants. We learn to understand the state of the case in these things also only through a highly evolved consciousness. How this is to be learned, I should like to explain to you in the following way. One prefers to describe things clearly when dealing with the spiritual world rather than to form abstract concepts. Let us suppose that we enter by means of initiate knowledge into the world where the dead are after their death. We follow them. It really happens that when we thus follow the dead, we seem to have entered into an entirely different world. I have partly described this. I have described to you how it makes a far more real impression than does our world in which we are between birth and death. But when we enter into this world, what amazes us at once, apart from the presence of the human dead, is the remarkable kinds of creatures to be found there. Immediately after a human being dies, if we follow him, we observe among the souls of the human being who are dead, and therefore round about the souls of those who have just died, remarkable forms of a demonic character. For example, immediately after the entrance into this land of the soul, I might say, into which the dead man enters, and which we may enter with him, by means of a certain clairvoyant perception, at the very entrance we see demonic forms that have tremendously huge, parenthesis naturally we use here an earthly analogy, if we speak of great and small we can speak only by way of analogy, parenthesis, which have huge, tremendously developed web feet like ducks, like all sorts of swimming creatures, tremendously developed web feet, like ducks or wild ducks, but constantly undergoing a transformation. Then they have a shape which one might compare in a way with the shape of a kangaroo, but half bird-like and half mammal-like, great mighty beings. When we follow the dead, we pass through entire extensive regions of such beings. But it is necessary that you form the right conception as to how one ought to think regarding the whereabouts of such beings, where they are. They are always around us, for we stand, indeed, in the same world wherein the dead are. They are always around us, these beings. Only, you must understand, they are not just now in this hall. Here begins, so to speak, the way of a real, entirely exact investigation. Imagine the following. You are walking over a meadow where many plants grow in autumn of the colchicum autumnale kind. Meadow saffron. You go along there now and you find everywhere meadow saffron. At the moment when you are standing in the midst of the meadow saffron, undertake to bring about that state of consciousness in which you can follow the dead, as I have explained to you. Then you see that wherever there is a meadow saffron, there is also that being I have described with those web feet and that remarkable kangaroo-like body. Every meadow saffron becomes such a being. Now you go to another region where the belladonna, the black deadly nightshade, grows along the road, and you put yourself into that state of consciousness of which I have spoken. Then you will meet with entirely different, terrible demonic beings, who also belong to the world of which I am speaking. We may say, therefore, that Colchicum autumnale and belladonna are mediums, which admit into themselves the world next to ours, and which in their other nature are really in the world of the dead. When you perceive this clearly, you will say to yourselves, quote, "Everywhere there exists round about us what we may call another world. It is only a question of entering into this through our consciousness, that we should not merely see Colchicum autumnale with our customary everyday consciousness, but should perceive it with our higher consciousness, where it exists in the realm of the dead. By means of the higher consciousness, we see belladonna where it exists, then in the realm of the dead." The following also you may say. Here, if you like, is a meadow, and on this meadow belladonna plants are growing. Now you must go a long distance, if you are in the physical world, perhaps even go up the entire slope of a mountain in the physical world. There on top are the bushes on which the deadly nightshade blossoms grow. Belladonna and Colchicum autumnale are not side by side in the physical world, but in that spiritual world, which is next to this and of which I am speaking, they are side by side. Space has quite another ordering there. Things that are far apart in the physical world may be quite close together in the spiritual world. The spiritual world has everywhere its very own laws. There, everything is different. Suppose now that you come upon these plants, we may use such an expression, in the world of the dead. When you follow the dead in their earliest period, parenthesis, and they do not at all have the terrible impressions which the man from the earth has of these plants, but they know that it is part of the wise plan of the world that these demon forms are there, parenthesis. When, therefore, you follow the dead at the beginning of the land of the soul, you find the land of the soul, the very nearest of the other worlds, occupied by those demon forms, those forms corresponding to the poison plants. If you go farther, then, toward those regions out of which the dead pass after 10, 20, 30 years, in order to enter a higher region, there you find for the first time that which corresponds to our non-poisonous plants. There for the first time you find, for example, the violet and similar plants that are not poisonous. Thus the world of plants has its significance here in the physical world and also in the next world. Only we see the plants there in other forms. What I have described in a true form in the realm of the stars is mirrored on earth in such a form as the belladonna has on earth, or the colchicum autumnale, or the violet. But this is reflected also in the world which the dead enter. Immediately after death it is mirrored in the way I have described. Everything existing in one world has its effect also in the other worlds. But if we desire to know this according to its actual nature, we must enter into its very own world by means of our consciousness. But the same thing is true as regards the beings of these other worlds. What these beings are, these elemental beings that are really the creatures of Ahrimanic rulers, this we shall be able to know only when we enter into the next world, which borders on our own. But they come out of that world by means of the medium, these beings. They get possession of the medium, and passing over in this way, they enter into our world. When, therefore, we learn to know these beings only by means of a medium in our own world, we are then learning to know them in a world to which they are really strangers, and for this reason we cannot become acquainted with them according to their true form. Therefore, anyone who learns to know these beings and their manifestations only through mediums cannot possibly arrive at the truth about them, because they are manifesting themselves in a world alien to them. Unquestionably, spiritual manifestations are occurring, but no understanding of the spiritual manifestation is possible if we become acquainted with it only in a world to which it does not belong. This is the deceptive aspect, which is, in the highest sense, illusory. In everything that enters into the world by means of the mediumistic consciousness, that is the fact that those who meet these beings do not know what is the real nature of such beings. (Clears throat) Moreover, the fact that these beings enter in such a way into this world causes them to have a very special fate. For you see, we learn to know something else when we learn to understand the world in just the way that I have explained. If a person enters into the world of the dead and passes through the demon forest of Colchicumatonale, of Belladonna, of Digitalis purpurea, of Datura stromonium, etc., if he passes through this whole region, he then observes that violets will be metamorphosed, that in the future they will take on entirely different forms. They possess a significance for the future of the cosmos. Colchicum autumnale, by its very nature, partakes of death, for which it is destined. These are dying plants, the poisonous plants, plants that are dying out, that will not continue in future forms. In future epochs there will be again other poisonous beings, but those beings which are today the poisonous beings are dying out in our epoch. Of course, the epoch lasts for a long time, but these beings carry within themselves the impulse of death, and this extends also over all vegetation. If we look with such a perception, we see in vegetation that which is going forward, evolving, carrying an impulse forward into the future, and that which is dying off, that which is uniting itself with death. So it is also with the beings that take possession of mediums. They sever themselves, in a sense, from their companions, whose mission it is to carry the present over into the distant future. By means of the medium, they force their way into this present world, but they unite themselves also with the fate of the earthly and lose their future mission. But they thereby also in large measure deprive a person of his future mission. And this is what we have in our immediate presence when we really learn to know the mediumistic nature. Let the future die. Thus really does the mediumistic nature say, let the present be all. It is for this reason also that when a person possessed of real insight into the facts and into that which is essential in the world goes to a spiritistic seance, he is at first astounded by the fact that all who are there, sitting in the circle and participating in the spiritistic manifestation, are surrounded by what appears to him in the form of poisonous plants. Every spiritistic seance is really surrounded by a garden of poisonous plants, which are not such as they are in the world of the dead, but which grow up round about this spiritistic company and out of whose blossoms and fruits demons arise. This is what one who looks into the other worlds sees, what he experiences at a spiritistic seance. He really passes generally through a hedge, through a world hedge, which surrounds a spiritistic company consisting of poisonous plants, which are, however, self-moving, which are living, which possess something of the nature of animals. Only by reason of their forms do we recognize that they are poisonous plants. But it is just in this way that we can see how powerfully what is working in this mediumistic form, what ought to flow forward with the course of human evolution, ought to become fruitful in the future, how this is conjured into the present to which it does not belong, and is evolved in the present to the injury of humanity. This is the inner mystery of the mediumistic nature, which we were to learn here in the course of these lectures. It is possible to specify completely, with entire accuracy, where the center of gravity, so to speak, of the human constitution lies in the mediumistic nature. Here I must place before you an apparently abstract explanation, but it is just this that will enable you to see a little into the essence of the mediumistic. You see, the human brain, as it is contained in the cavity of the skull, possesses an average weight of 1,500 grams, or somewhat more. This is really a considerable weight. And it is really a fact that if this human brain, with its own weight, should press upon the delicate blood vessels in the head beneath it, it would at once crush these blood vessels. We human beings go about in the world a longer or shorter time according to the age we attain, and our brain does not work with its weight, with its gravity, upon the system of blood vessels beneath it. We understand this fact at once as soon as we look upon it in the right manner. Consider a human being as he is constructed. You then see that the spinal canal in the human being extends upward and spreads out into the brain. The entire arrangement is such that the spinal canal, with the exception of certain parts that are not completely but only half filled, is filled with fluid. In this fluid the brain is really floating. The human brain really floats in the cerebral fluid. Now there is such a thing as the principle of Archimedes. You have probably learned this in your study of physics. This principle of Archimedes is derived from the ancient wise man Archimedes, of whom it is related that he discovered this principle through his genius while he was in the bath. He made this obvious experiment. With his whole body in the water, he kept raising his legs alternately out of the bath, and in this way he observed that the legs possessed a different weight for him according as they were in the water or out of it. They are heavy when they are outside the water. They lose weight immediately when they are in the water. For such a person as Archimedes, this was something quite different from what it would be for an ordinary man. An ordinary man would merely play with it. But Archimedes made thereby a great, tremendous discovery. "Eureka, I have it!" he exclaimed. For he had discovered in this way that every body which floats in another body, in a medium, that is, floats in a fluid, loses in this fluid as much of its weight as the weight of the fluid it displaces. Let us imagine a vessel filled with water. I place in this a solid body. If I make it possible to weigh this by suspending it, I can find out quite accurately that the body weighs less in water, becomes lighter in water than it is outside. And certainly if you imagine a man of a mass of water of the same volume, this also, as a body of water, would possess weight. And just as much of this weight, so much must you subtract from the weight of this body when it is in the water. The body loses in water as much of its weight as the weight of an equal volume of water. This is the principle of Archimedes. This principle of Archimedes serves us, as human beings, in good stead in our constitutions, for the brain floats in the cerebral fluid and thus loses as much of its weight as the weight of a volume of the cerebral fluid equal to that of the brain. Thus our brain, as we bear it within us, does not weigh 1,500 grams, but loses it in weight the equivalent of a water brain. It loses 1,480 grams and retains only about 20 grams. We therefore bear within us, in reality, not a brain of 1,500 grams, but only one of 20 grams. According to the principle of Archimedes, the rest of the weight is lost by reason of the fact that the brain is floating in the cerebral fluid. Thus we have in our brain organization something much lighter than it actually is. We carry the brain within us only to the extent of 20 grams. But we must give most careful attention to just these 20 grams, for these 20 grams alone possess the capacity to receive our ego. All the rest of us we have elsewhere. Now the rest of our body is also filled with all sorts of solid parts floating in fluid, for example, the blood corpuscles. These all lose in weight. Only a little of the weight remains. The ego exists also in this, so that the ego is spread out in the blood, but not with the weight of the blood. To all this we must give attention, to all that retains any noticeable weight as we go about. Indeed, you must all give the most careful attention to what resides in the heavy part of the brain and is still heavy in the original sense of the word. For it is in this that your ego can be. Otherwise it cannot be anywhere. Everywhere else there must be astral body, ether body, etc. Now a medium is a human being in whom this heavy part of the constitution, that is to say the 20 grams of brain, does not any longer contain the ego. Out of this gravity, out of this weight, the ego has been driven. Then those beings of whom I have spoken can immediately enter into these parts. You must observe also something special in what I am explaining to you. The materialistic manner of thinking is always inclined to point out locality. It asks the question, yes, but where is the part of the human being in which the elemental being takes up its abode when it overpowers the medium? Only the materialistic understanding speaks in this way. This is the manner in which one speaks who thinks mechanically, who thinks mathematically. Life, however, does not proceed mathematically and mechanically, but dynamically. It must not be said, therefore, that the medium is possessed here or there in such a way as to localize the thing mathematically or geometrically. But we must say that the medium is possessed in that part which remains heavy within him, in that part which draws downward to the earth. It is there that the Aramanic beings can enter, and not only there, but also somewhere else. You must understand that this is only the most rudimentary part of the thing that I have explained to you exactly, the most rudimentary. There is a subtler element involved. How do we see on the physical plane? There we have our eyes. From the eyes, the optic nerve extends backward to the brain. The optic nerve spreads out in the eye and then extends backward to the brain. The optic nerve constitutes the basis for the experience of color. Now, the materialist thinks about the manner in which the optic nerve impresses colors upon the brain and discharges the colors there. For the materialist imagines everything to be like the cargo of a ship or the freight on a railroad train. Something from without is loaded on the sense organ, is transported in the nerves, and is then discharged somewhere, enters into the soul, not in quite so crass a manner, but it amounts to the same thing. But the facts are entirely and utterly different. The fact is that the optic nerve does not exist for the purpose of carrying back to the brain the experience of color, but that it exists for the purpose of obliterating the color at a certain definite point. The color resides only externally on the periphery. It is the mission of the optic nerve to obliterate the color more and more as it passes inward, so that the brain is as colorless as possible, so that only the very faintest vanishing colors enter into the brain. Not only is the color obliterated, but also every relationship to the external world is obliterated in the brain. Hearing and sight are in the senses. In the direction of the brain, the optic nerve, the auditory nerve, the nerve of warmth, obliterate to a faint shadow everything that you possess on the periphery. The faint shadow is in the same relationship to the experience as the 20 grams are to the 1500 grams. The 20 grams are also only a shadow of the weight of the brain. So what we still have there is very little. When we have a vast, tremendous dawn which exists in our senses, we have behind in the brain a faint shadow of this. To this faint shadow we must again give attention, for only there can our ego reside. The very moment that our ego is shut out, that we become mediumistic, such an elemental being as I have described immediately creeps into this feeble shadow, or into the feeble tone which comes to us from hearing, into everything wherein the ego belongs, where the external experience of the senses is obliterated. There does this being creep in, there does it take possession of the medium. And it then creeps even into the branching of the nerves, even into the shaping of the will, that is, even into those nerves which enter into the shaping of the will. The result of this is that the medium begins to be active, because that within him has been seized which ought to be taken hold of by the human ego alone. The residue of the weight of the brain, the residue of the experience of color, of the experience of sound, all this delicate shadow-like element that fills us like a phantom, for this 20 grams of weight is only a phantom, these faint shadows of the colors that enter into us are phantom-like. Into this dives this phantom, this elemental being. Then the entire man comes to such a state that he lies there at complete rest as regards his body, quite lethargic, and everything becomes active within him, which really ought to be filled by the ego, in these feeble, phantom-like shadows which are otherwise filled by the ego. Observe the medium, then. A medium can be a medium only by permitting everything that is used by the normal human being to fall into a lethargy, into an absolute inertness, and by having this phantom become active, which I have described. You can detect this, for example, in the manner in which the medium writes. He naturally could not write at all, but for the fact that everything within, just as in the brain, has become lighter. For everything that is heavy is floating in fluid and becomes light to the feeling, to the experience, and he writes in that wherein, as in what is light, the ego ordinarily guides the pen. The elemental being now, in the case of the medium, guides the pen in this human phantom. You see, it is really a fact that when the medium is thus sitting there, or shows himself in any other manner, another world is really reaching into this world. Just as the beings of another world, these Aramanic beings, can reach into this world by means of the movements of the medium, so can they also in the emanations, in all the emanations that I described yesterday. There are always present tremendous fluid emanations, especially in those regions of the human organization where there are glands. Into these fluid emanations, therefore, there penetrate likewise such beings of the elemental world, and likewise into the exhalations of the air, of the breath, and into the radiations of light. Only when the chemical emanations are concerned is there a conscious intercourse between one who employs these chemical emanations and those beings that enter into these chemical emanations. But here there begins, as I described yesterday, black magic, a conscious working with those beings who enter in the manner that I have described. In the case of the medium, and generally also in the case of those who experiment with mediums, there is really no consciousness of the actual events occurring. In the case of the black magician, there appears generally a full consciousness of the fact that he is attracting into the chemical emanations of human beings, mostly into his own, those beings of the elemental world. The black magician is therefore really always surrounded by a host of servants, consisting of such elemental beings, whom he enables, either through his own emanations or through fumes that he creates in his laboratory, to employ occult chemical impulses here in the physical world of the senses. This leads us to the following knowledge. Just as the belladonna grows up into a world to which it does not belong, and thereby becomes poisonous, so does the spiritual world grow by means of the medium into our world that we inhabit between birth and death. But fundamentally considered, the danger is always near at hand that the spiritual world may grow into this world in a manner similar to that which I have described in the case of the belladonna, whenever the state of consciousness, that is, the realization of the ego by the human being, is suppressed, where the human being is in a benumbed state, in a state like that of a swoon, or in an actual swoon. Whenever human consciousness is dulled, not by normal sleep, but in some other way, there is the danger that a window may thus be opened for the world that I have described. What a tremendous role this plays in human life, this opening of such windows through the dulling of human consciousness. We shall hear further tomorrow and in the following lectures. The end of Lecture 8.